The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Everyone? And as a prelude to my talk, occasionally a distinction is made between people who are beginners in practice, meditation practice or Buddhist practice, and those who are advanced, whatever that is. One of the qualities of someone who's an advanced practitioner is that they're willing to be beginners more often. And so we start over again with the basics. And one of the most basic aspects of meditation practice and of mindfulness, of Buddhist spirituality, is mindfulness of breathing, paying attention to the breath, and coming back to the breath, and making it really simple, starting over again. And even the idea of the word language of your mind wanders off and then you come back to the breath is, I think maybe it's a little bit unfortunate, because the mind doesn't go anywhere, just we have this metaphor of moving the mind. But I prefer the idea of we start over rather than coming back. Just wherever we're at, we start again, and we start again. And the willingness to start fresh and over again without the baggage of judgments about what just happened or the past, and just start fresh, new, is a sign of an advanced practitioner. And some beginners are more advanced than the people who have been practicing for a long time, because they have much like the quality of just willing to start over and just be connected and do it again. And so in a number of Buddhist traditions, focusing on the breath, tuning into the breath, is at the heart of the practice. And in doing that, it's in common with a lot of other spiritual traditions where focusing on the breath, paying attention to the breath, is also central and very important. Sometimes it's important as a practice, and sometimes it's important in the ancient language in which the religion is kind of couched or comes out of. So, for example, I don't know how many Christians focus on breathing, but you have at the beginning of Genesis that the story there is that human life began when God breathed into a bunch of stardust to gather together. And what else all we are, right, is stardust. But there's something that animates it. And so this idea of what the animating force, or the breath that gets breathed in, that God breathed into Adam, brought life. And then the word, I'm very fond that the word spiritual comes from the Latin word spirit, spiritus, which means breath, or can mean breath, breathing. And so like respiration, it clearly has it in it. And I wonder sometimes if instead of saying that the world had different spiritual traditions, we said the world has different breathing traditions. Wouldn't that be nice? Then immediately we're connected to our commonality, that we share the breath in common, breathing in common. And we're co-conspirators. we're all breathing together, conspiring together. Maybe there's a little more harmony between different religions. And I certainly noticed that people who practice a spiritual discipline, regardless of the spiritual tradition, religion they're part of, very quickly they can find commonality, shared commonality, because they're negotiating and working with a common human experience. If the starting point of inter-spiritual, inter-religious dialogue is beliefs, then it's very quick. We can come very quickly to the differences. But if we start in practices, then I think we come to our commonalities much more quickly. And if we can come to how we work with the breath, what happens to the benefits of the breath, I think we come very quickly to a very shared spiritual life, shared breathing life. We breathe, it said, I don't know, I haven't counted, but it said that we breathe 23,000 times a day, some of us. And that's a lot of times. There's this rhythm of breathing in and breathing out. And a lot goes on in breathing. Breathing's not a kind of a neutral thing. But it's easy to overlook the breath because most things that people are interested in their life are not the breathing. We're interested in our relationships to other people. We're interested in our work. We're interested in our pleasures. We're interested in our safety and making ourselves safe. We're interested in our money. We're interested in all kinds of things that the mind gets preoccupied in. And there's, generally not a lot of monetary value in your breathing. And or generally, people don't associate their breath with a lot of pleasure. Whereas, in fact, it's a tremendous amount of pleasure can come with breathing. But it's not like, you don't go to school and they don't tell you, growing up, the breath has within it ecstatic pleasure if you just kind of tuned into it. You get messages that other things are important. My son's interested in his iPod, not his breathing. To get him interested in his breathing, I think it would be hopeless. And so there's this focus on other things, and as we get focused on other things, one of the tendencies is to fixate on things and to get obsessed on things, get preoccupied with things. And there's a lot of things to be get preoccupied with. Some of it has to do with our responsibilities, some of it has to do with our fears, some of it has to do with our desires. But one way or the other, people get really interested in things, and it's beautiful to get interested in things. But to be fixated has a consequence, and one of the consequences of fixation is we hold our breath. And there's an exercise that's done sometimes in breathing workshops of having people, with their eyes, focus on a spot in front of them, really fixate on the spot. And most people find if they do that, that in order to fixate and hold their attention on that spot, that people hold their breath to some degree. So the same thing happens in our mind. If the thinking or our mental attention gets fixated on something, it often translates to an effect on our breathing. If we pay attention to the breath and keep the breath fluid, moving, then it's harder to fixate. And it can overcome that fixation. Or if the mind gets locked in really tight around something, one of the things that you're often advised to do is to breathe. Breathe deeply and relax with the breath. One of the fixations people can have is around fear. They get fixated on their fear. It gets sometimes up to the point of panic. And then encouraging you to breathe deeply, or just to breathe, tune into your breath, is one of the classic techniques. It was the first instruction I received from my first Zen teacher. Was I went to have an interview with him, and I'd never had a one-on-one interview with a Zen teacher, a Buddhist teacher, ever before. And I was, 22 years old. And I got really nervous. I was so nervous, I couldn't speak. And now all I do is speak. but I couldn't speak. And he had to tell me, Gil, just breathe deeply. So I breathe deep a little bit, and then eventually I can kind of loosen up and have the conversation. When we breathe, and breathe in a, just tuning into the breath, especially if you can tune into the breath and relax with the breath, it tends to translate to freeing up, to some degree, the fixations, the tightness in the mind and the preoccupations we have. Maybe not 100%, but it begins that process of loosening things up. So, sometimes even breathing out more intentionally. Some people find breathing a long, slow out-breath, taking a deep breath and slow, long out-breath is a powerful way to begin relaxing the stress and the tension that gets built up. Doing that a dozen times when you're feeling tense is a beautiful thing, a very helpful thing to do. The problem is that many times when people feel tense, really tense, it goes with a kind of sense of urgency, like I have to take care of something or do something now. And the idea of taking a little break for 10 breaths can seem like I don't have time for that. And so we don't avail ourselves of the possibility of just relaxing. I've encouraged a number of people to use the excuse of going to the bathroom to step out of their normal life and breathe for a while. Because most people are not going to be upset with you or be concerned about you if you say, excuse me, I need to go to the bathroom. You don't have to tell them what you're doing. Most people don't ask you, what are you doing? Or you can call it, it's better, maybe you call it, I'm going to the restroom. What are you doing in the restroom? I'm resting. And then you go sit there in the toilet and you breathe. Whether or not you have to pee, you just breathe. And then you come back out and you've done your 10 breaths. The other thing about breathing is that it's stabilizing. And sometimes we're not necessarily fixated in our mind, but we're quite unstable. The mind is agitated, it's running around, it feels confused, it feels lost, and we feel kind of vulnerable and fragile. And then tuning into the breath is kind of like an anchor, a stabilizing force that connects people to their body, connects people to some kind of rhythm that is constant, that keeps moving through us and going through us. And having that rhythm and that constancy of breathing in and breathing in and out, for some people, it creates the kind of stability or discipline or that helps them in times of great instability. Tuning into the breath also provides us with a lot of information about ourselves. And one of the values of paying attention to breathing is the way in which we learn about ourselves. Because almost any tendency of mind that we have, any emotion, mood, concern of the mind we have, it's translated into how we breathe. And unless your breath is really contracted to begin with, if you're really contracted and your breath is tense in your chest or your belly's held in, then there's no room to have any more effect on your breath. And so then, you know, there won't be much more. But when your breath is relaxed and fluid, then you can watch your breathing and see how it changes, sometimes very minutely, depending on what's going on around you. And we see that, right? If suddenly you're walking down the street and then suddenly you pick up your pace and walk faster, your breathing correspondingly changes. And if you come to a stop for a red light, perhaps the breathing changes again. But it also, the breath is affected by our emotions. I found it kind of fun to sometimes watch my breathing and my emotions, but my breathing when I'm driving on a freeway and see the subtle changes that go on depending on what goes on around me with the traffic. And unless I consciously pay attention to the breath, I won't notice the subtle changes, but I can see how those changes are connected to the subtle emotions that are going on. A police car pulls up behind me. And I don't know about you, but it affects me. You know, even if I'm innocent, it has an effect. And I wake up. Uh-oh, what? I look around and make sure that, and it affects my breathing. Or someone pulls up a little bit too fast in front of me, it cuts me off, and it affects my breathing. There's a whole series of things that goes on there. It can be subtle. But sometimes our life is not so subtle, like just, in the freeway. Sometimes there's big things that goes on. And it's hard sometimes to notice how we're feeling, even emotionally, if we're preoccupied with something. I've certainly been in situations where I'm so concerned with the outcome and getting my way that I haven't noticed how I'm actually feeling. And sometimes how I'm feeling is not helpful for the situation. I'm starting getting irritated or annoyed or angry, and I don't know that because I'm so focused on getting my way and whatever needs to happen. But I've learned that by making a habit of coming back to my body and paying attention to my breathing, the breathing and what goes on in my body can sometimes guide me or tell me what emotion is going on. When I feel the breathing contracted and held in some way, that's usually an indication for me to stop and pay more careful attention. If my belly is held in, that's sometimes an indication to relax my belly. And when I relax my belly, then I become aware of what I was feeling in a way that I was not aware, when I was kind of caught up in something. And there's sometimes chronically held emotions or attitudes about life that are held in the way we breathe. Some people breathe in for their whole lifetime in certain ways. Remember the first time I really saw this clearly was I was teaching a retreat in, it was a rented facilities in a Catholic convent. And And it was kind of interesting at the opening of the very opening evening of the retreat, there were some nuns in the convent who were kind of welcoming us and showing us how to use the rooms and stuff. And so they were nice people, just kind of friendly and relaxed with us. And then the retreatants started coming in, and this one woman in her 60s walked into the room, you know, wearing ordinary lay clothes. And she kind of walked in, and when she walked into the room, the two nuns who were talking with us stood at attention, like it was the military. It was quite something, you know. And what it turned out was that the woman who came in had been a sister in the monastery for many years. In fact, was one of the most senior sisters, or maybe was Mother Superior for a while. But then some years earlier had left the order and gone on to study psychology and was a therapist. But when she came back to do the meditation retreat with us, the nuns remembered her. And I guess, you know, she was, I don't know what kind of person she was, but the kind of person that you want to stand at attention for. And I'm sure that the women at attention, their breathing changed. But what happened was, in the course of the retreat, the Mother Superior talked about having some breathing issues. And she kept wanting to yawn during meditation a lot. And so I thought, well, let me have her do a guided meditation around her breathing. And let's see what happens, what we can uncover as we do this. And so I had her close her eyes, and I was just kind of getting started with, you know, getting her relaxed a little bit so we can explore what was going on under the breathing. So I told her, relax your belly. And she immediately burst into tears. And what she said was that she realized then that she had been told as a young girl, way back when, that as a woman, she was always supposed to hold her stomach in. And she had internalized that and spent a lifetime holding her belly in. And it was quite an effect for her to actually be given the instruction to relax your belly. No one had ever told her that. And so tears came pouring. So the way, you know, the lifetime of holding, because sometimes people have a lifetime of attitudes. People have a lifetime attitude of fear or apprehension, that the anxiety they carry with them, and that gets translated in ways that we breathe. People have a lifetime of a conceit, and of holding themselves up in a certain way, and that translates into their posture, which translates into their breath. So as we begin paying attention to the breath, there's a whole world of things that begins to open up. The breath is stabilizing, it's relaxing, but it also gives us a lot of information about ourselves. And that information is very important, at least for our mindfulness tradition, because we're trying to understand how we operate so we can let go of ways that we operate which are not helpful for us, and can operate in ways or behave in ways that are useful for us. And so as we learn, you know, I'm holding on to this, or I'm always anxious, or I'm always this way, or we see we react to situations, and we can see how we react, then we can decide, is this useful to stay this way, stay tense, or should I relax? And so then, hopefully you understand it's helpful to relax. And so then you begin the process of maybe relaxing. This focus on the breath and paying attention to breath is so significant and so incredibly helpful that there's a story in this book, The Monastery Within. So hopefully you allow me to breathe. A scholar came to the abbess and explained, "I have spent a lifetime studying Buddhism, and it has not helped me much. What am I missing? What is it I need to understand?" To prepare the scholar for her answer, the abbess sat silent for a while. Then she said, Breathe in an easy and relaxed way, and then study what causes you to lose that ease. Everything you really need to know about Buddhism will be found in that investigation." That's quite something, right? So the instruction is first, breathe in an easy and relaxed way. So that takes a while to find that. But then pay very careful attention to what causes you to lose that relaxed breath. And when you notice how the relaxed breath is lost, pay attention to what just happened. Go back and study that. And here it says that everything you need to know about Buddhism will be found in that investigation. Because what you'll discover is how you relate to the world. And if you understand really well how you relate to your world, Buddhism is about freeing that relationship so you don't relate to the world in a way that causes suffering, that involves attachment and clinging. And so the breath is a window back into, one of the windows back into understanding how you're relating to the world. And then you can do a very interesting thing, I think. And that is, if you notice that your breath has gotten constricted or tight, you lost your relaxed breath, you can look and see, is this really, you know, is this really worth it? Sometimes maybe it is. Maybe it's your breath is speeded up because you're exercising at the gym. You know, that's okay. But there are times, you know, if you're at a meeting or just around your house and you're trying to do a lot of cleaning and you get really greedy or anxious about getting as much done as possible as quickly as you can. Or you have something that you enjoy doing, but you have other responsibilities, so you hold on to what you enjoy doing, but you feel that holding on to it also affects your breathing. So there's many ways in which our breath is affected. And then, if you're not willing to go back to a relaxed breath, then the question is, debate with yourself. Looking more deeply into what are the beliefs that you operate by that tell you that it's okay to sacrifice your relaxed breath. Do you have beliefs? And probably you do, if you're not willing to relax. Oh, I have a lot to do. It's more important to get all these things done than it is to relax. It's a frightening world. And it's more important to stay tense and on alert than it is to relax. What are the beliefs that go on? It doesn't matter. That's another one people have sometimes. Oh, it's just a little bit of tension. It doesn't really matter. You know, it's this breath thing, you know, tension, you know. That's not what real spiritual life is. You know, so one of the great ones is, I think, you know, I've done this. You know, you're going to come to IMC to meditate so you can relax and tune into your breath and have a relaxed, smooth breath. And but you're willing to tense up to get here. I'm late. Got to get in my car. Got to get hurry here. You know, why? I mean, why tense up so you can come someplace? Maybe that's why you need to tense up so you can come someplace where you can relax, right? I would suggest relax before you come. You know, even if it means coming late. You know, we're set up here. We'd prefer if people don't come late, but we're intentionally set up here so that it's okay for people to come late because we realize people have complicated lives in an urban setting, and we want people to feel welcome when they come. So, you know, I'd rather you came with a relaxed breath than came all tense on time. So what are the beliefs that operate is a very interesting one. Look at your beliefs. One of the interesting beliefs, you know, has to do with getting a lot of things done. And so, you know, maybe if you keep coming late to IMC, because Gil said it's okay as long as you keep your breath relaxed. You know, if you keep doing it, then you might want to look back further in time and say, well, why am I keep coming late? It's because you have all this greed to do a lot of things. You know, maybe Sunday, right? So maybe the Sunday paper, you know, I'm going to read as much of the Sunday paper as I can. And then you have to rush here, you know. I don't have to rush, I can just come late. Maybe you have to look at the holding on the attachment, small maybe as it is, to, you know, trying to do a lot of things. What I'm trying to point out is that the breath is a source of a lot of information. And we can engage in the breath and tap into the information that's there and engage with it in very creative ways and interesting ways. One of the pieces of information from focusing on the breath at some point is to notice who it is that's noticing the breath. especially in meditation, to notice what kind of attention you use to pay attention to breath. So in the first, the task is just to start stabilizing the attention on the breath and find yourself getting concentrated in the breath so you're here over time. But as you're kind of able to stay with the breath longer and longer, then at some point the attention can turn around and you look at how are you paying attention to the breath. So some people pay attention to the breath with tremendous driving ferocity. I've known people when they come back to the breath, they don't just come back quietly and matter-of-factly. They pounce back at the breath. They have this attitude of, shoot, I'm doing the wrong thing again, and wandered off, and they jerk that poor mind back. Come back! Come back. And, you know, it's kind of sad in there. And so, but if you stop and look at, and some people never occur to them to look at how they pay attention to the breath because the instruction is pay attention to the breath. And, but so if you turn around and look and say, oh, well, you realize, wow, it's a little struggle in there. There's all this, it's kind of violent the way I do it. Or other people find that you know, there's hardly, you know, getting back to the breath is a good idea and, you know, I'll get to it at some point and, I know it's important and, you don't want to make too much effort in this, because I might get tense and you're not supposed to get tense, and so I'll get around to it tomorrow. So you know, kind of a laziness or kind of a little bit too or sometimes there's fear connected with even something like paying attention to the present moment or paying attention to the breath. And one of the reasons why there's sometimes fear connected to the breathing is that some people hold their breath as a way of protecting themselves. And an interesting phenomena that I've seen a few people is that some people are not willing to breathe out all the way. They start breathing out and then they interrupt the end of the out-breath by breathing in. Because breathing out all the way, there's a kind of letting go of control at the end of the out-breath. And letting go of control is frightening for some people. And so their letting go of control, it gets translated into how they breathe. And so so then if you pay attention to how you pay attention, you see that in the attention, in the breath, is an attempt to try to control your situation. So there's control going on. And it's not uncommon for people to come to me and say, I'm troubled by controlling my breath. I'm the one who's controlling my breath, and it feels very uncomfortable. The general approach in our mindfulness tradition is to encourage people not to worry about that if you're controlling your breath. You're not supposed to control if you control it intentionally, you know, like you do yogic breathing. In our tradition, we encourage you to stop doing that, just stop. But some people control their breath kind of unconsciously. They can't stop doing it. If that's the case, we encourage you to relax. It's really okay. Because the task in mindfulness meditation is, the first task is to notice what is, not to make it different. So if you have a controlled breath, your task is to become the world connoisseur of what it's like to have a controlled breath. Get interested, get curious. Start exploring all the ins and outs, all the different places in your body that are affected by the control, how your control is happening, what gets held, what gets tight. What are the emotions? What is the tendency of the mind? Get really curious. And that'll do a number of things. One thing it does is it frees you from being anxious about the control. Because anxiety about control sometimes is the very thing that keeps fueling the control. So if you stop being anxious, relax, it becomes easier. The second is that as you begin curious and bring investigation into the controlledness of the breath, less and less energy is going into the control and more energy is going into the investigation. And so the control begins to relax itself. The other is that as you understand more of the details of what's going on with the control, you might see what you can do to relax and let go. That's one of the reasons why you can't let go of the control is because you don't really see the details of actually how it's operating. So we turn back sometimes, start noticing what we bring with us as we pay attention. There could be there can be fear that's there, and that fear can translate into breathing. There can be strong desire. Some people, you know, sit down to meditate, and they're really trying to get someplace in their meditation. There's nothing wrong to want to get someplace in meditation in some easy, open-handed way. But there's a lot of meditators. I bet there's meditators in this room even, who have tied themselves in knots trying to attain something, get something, strive, push. And one of the great headaches for meditators is to have a really beautiful, deep meditation experience. You're like, wow, that was great. And then try to recreate it. Come back the next time and I'm going to do it again. And they try and they try and push, and, you know, they're trying to make it happen. And so there's desire, expectation, striving that's in how we're paying attention. So to stabilize the attention on breath meditation, and then at some point turn the attention around to notice the qualities of that attention itself. What's there with the attention? And because the attention is somewhat stable, there might be possible to more likely have a chance to notice something that's usually very subtle, which is the quality of attention itself. And the fact that attention, the quality of attention is subtle, doesn't mean that it's insignificant. It's probably one of the significant aspects of our life. The kind of fundamental operating principles of our life, that what holds our life together or motivates it or drives it, is at its root, it's probably very closely connected to the attitudes associated with how we pay attention itself. And generally, there's always an attitude in how we pay attention. There's an approach. There's something we're trying to do. And it's kind of akin to, maybe you've seen someone who's been really afraid. Maybe like, you know, like a deer trapped in the headlights kind of thing. You can see it in their eyes. And you see that everywhere they're looking with fear. You can see it's there. You know, it's kind of dramatic there. And it can be that way with our attention as well. The attention itself can be infused with some kind of attitude. And even if we have overriding attitudes, like, you know, if suddenly we win the California lottery and we're elated, or, you know, or we're, you know, we get fired from our job and we're sad or angry. Those are kind of momentary, or the kind of things that rise and pass, but then there's a kind of a constant background attitude that is there as well. And sometimes it's but through meditation where you get quiet and quiet and quiet enough that you can see the background attitude and how it operates. And then to create kind of a let go of what's not helpful and perhaps and maintain what is helpful with that. One of the things that we see as we focus on the breathing and look back at the attitude or how we hold or how we're paying attention is we can see how much self there is operating in it. How much there's me, myself, and mine. I'm the one who's having the experience. I'm the one who's doing the breath meditation. I'm the one who's in charge here. I'm the one who has to have an experience. I'm the one who, you know, whatever. And one of the possibilities as we tune into the breath meditation, the constancy, the rhythm of it, getting into the rhythm and the regularity of it, is to begin losing our self-consciousness and to be able to tune into the breath and be with the breath without any sense of I with it. And that's a beautiful thing because the sense, the active sense of I, is a form of suffering. I like to call it, someone once asked me, what is that, what is the I in Buddhism? The self in Buddhism. And I said, it's wind drag. Because it just slows you down, you know, to operate by. It's like sticking out your hand out the window or something of the car. So this is Suzuki Roshi in his book Zen Mind Beginner's Mind wrote, when we practice Zazen, Zazen is Zen meditation, when we practice Zazen, our mind always follows our breathing. When we inhale, The air comes into the inner world. When we exhale, the air goes out to the outer world. The inner world is limitless, and the outer world is also limitless. We say inner world or outer world, but actually there is only one whole world. In this limitless world, our throat is like a swinging door. The air comes in and goes out like someone passing through a swinging door. If you think, I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. What we call I is just a swinging door which moves when we inhale and when we exhale. It just moves, that is all. When your mind is pure and calm enough to follow this movement, there is nothing, no I, no world, no mind, nor body, just a swinging door. So as we learn this whole territory of breath, staying with the breath, getting stabilized and focused, and we begin clarifying and understanding our inner life in deeper ways, and then we can learn to simplify it and relax it and let it become more peaceful and more peaceful. And as it becomes more peaceful and restful, all the extra things we do in our mind can settle away. And I-making, my-making, me-making is really extra, more often than not. And then to have a palpable, visceral experience of peace, of what Suzuki Roshi maybe calls limitless beingness, without the I-making, me-making, and mind-making operating, shows us a possibility that very few people know about. If we don't know that it's possible to live without I-making, me-making, mind-making, then we're going to hold on to I-making, me-making, and mind-making tenaciously. But if we know that there's an alternative, then we might be willing more often in our life, when it's appropriate, to let go of all that and to be present in our life without needing to have a self operating. Just be present in this limitless life, in this open, boundless life, in this place where perhaps we can meet each other as human beings who just share the spirit of breath, the spiritus of breath together. We share an open mind together. We share a limitless, boundless heart together in the same place at the same time. It's a beautiful thing. I hope that the world can be made up of many breathing traditions and that we will all share it. So those are a few thoughts about breathing. And we have 5 minutes. If any of you would like to ask a question or make a comment or protest. Yes, please.
When you were talking about becoming a connoisseur of your, in that case, controlled breathing, how is that different from analysis? In other words, we get the instruction not to try and analyze, but how is that different?
I don't think there's a sharp line between it. So it's more like what the emphasis. So in mindfulness, the investigation of mindfulness is about what's going on in the present moment. I think in analysis, more often than not, the tendency is to go back in time to understand the causes and conditions. So, but here we're investigating what's here and now. But we're not, in addition to that though, we're not doing a lot of analytical thinking about it. It's not like we're going in there and kind of thinking our way and kind of analyzing. Is this, there's a little bit of that going on. There might be a little bit kind of, say, you know, I feel about, I'm controlling my breath. And so there might be a very simple little thought that says, it seems like it's happening mostly with a lot of tightness in my chest. Let me go and feel that tightness in a deeper way. So it's a very simple, rudimentary thought. So let me feel it. And so, and then you go in and you feel and sense as a sensual experience, sensory experience, that tightness, and you hang out and feel it and get to know it really well, what it's like. But you don't start analyzing which muscles are operating and get an anatomy book and, you know, and try to, you know, it's not that kind of analysis. So it's a lot, so I think of it as mindfulness investigation. A lot of it has to do with feeling in the sense of sensing what's going on in a deeper, deeper way.
Gil, you said something last week and it reminded me, it brought it up today, the distinction between when you said it's good to be interested in something and the distinction between commitment and attachment. You mentioned it and wondered if you could elaborate on it.
The difference between commitment and attachment. Attachment means we're clinging to something. Commitment means that we're intent on it and we're going to keep doing it. But you can do that without attachment. So, you know, it's like a relationship. Many people will make commitments in their relationships of all kinds. And it's important then to maintain those commitments. And it's possible to maintain them without attachment. It's possible to maintain them with attachment. But it means you keep coming back and you keep that as a guideline of your behavior and what you're going to do, and you stay true to that. To have a commitment to meditation practice every morning, for example, is a beautiful thing to do. It means that no matter what else is going on, you're set, you're intent, you're resolved that this is what you're going to do. But you pay enough attention to notice when you get attached to that, so you don't get attached, you don't cling or get contracted. And if something really happens that becomes impossible for you to follow through in your commitment, you know you gave it your best try, but the house is burning, so, you know, you know, this is not the time to meditate. So you're relaxed about that. Whereas if you're attached to it, you know, maybe your house is not burning, then maybe, you know, how many houses down the street? If it's neighbors, you probably get up and do something, right? But if it's 2 blocks away, 3 blocks away, you know, what point do you, this is my precious meditation. I can't go look. Yes?
This is a comment, really. This is loud. Recently on the computer, I came across one of the TED Talks by a woman whose first name, I don't remember, her last name was Taylor, I believe. She was a neuropsychologist at Harvard. She'd had a brain tumor in her left side of her brain. I don't know if you're familiar with this at all.
I haven't read her book. She has a best-selling book
experience. Yeah, it's basically a description of that. And the fascinating thing for me is she went through a process, brain tumor, stroke in her left side of her brain, which basically took her 10 years to recover from. And during this process, especially during the time, she was observing herself as a scientist would. And she completely lost the ability, she lost her sense of self completely, her sense of I, completely during this period. And I don't know if it's the same thing that you're talking about, but it seems by her description to be the same. Where for this, when she went through this period of the stroke, she completely lost her boundaries between herself and everything around her. She lost her sense of I, and it was a very wonderful period for her. Now she's recovered, she felt she had the ability to go back and forth between these two states. And I wanted to ask you, in a sense, if that's the same thing you're talking about when you talk about this no I, or no self.
Yeah, I feel not quite qualified to, you know, refer to how she talks about in the book, since I haven't read it. But one of the lessons from a book like that, an experience like that, is that the process of selfing, process of identifying a self, or even the process of seeing something as mine, like they say, even to look at your hand and see, this is my hand, as innocent and obvious that is, it requires a certain kind of neurological functioning to happen, and people who have certain kind of damage in their brain can look at their hand and they don't see it as their hand. It's kind of like bizarre for those of us who it seems obvious, right? But it's still a neurological functioning. And so if it's a functioning, some of that functioning, you know, in terms of it being a mental functioning, it's possible to relax it and let it go. And so that means it's optional. And so if it's optional, then it belongs to the area of life where we could, in theory, have some monitor ourselves and have some choice about what we pick up and what we don't pick up. So they have the ability to go into a deep state of peace where the I disappears and have that functioning go away. It's beautiful in its own right. It's beautiful, it's deep. Some people add a lot of metaphysical religious ideas on top of that. That means I'm one with the cosmos, it means I'm one with God, it means whatever. But, you know, in Buddhism we tend to keep it really simple. It just is deep peace where the self is let go of. We don't have to add anything, make it more complicated. But then we see, as I said earlier, see it's possible to operate without that sense of self. As the self comes back in, we don't want to get attached to that state. We don't want to go around. I don't think Buddhists want to go around in some kind of ethereal space of just kind of like no self here, and you know, just kind of, you know, that's not useful to anybody, really. But what it allows us to do is to be much more have much more choice and responsibility for how we pick up the self when we pick it up again. We see that it's a functioning and there's a choice, there's an optionality in it and a creativity in it. And so we can then pick it up and hold it more lightly, be more creative in how we use it. We know when it's useful to use and when it's not to use. And so we're willing, much more willing to fluid with it. And we see that in some ways pretty obvious things, like if someone has a role, and they try to act in the world from that role when it's no longer appropriate, then they're attached to a certain idea of self. And so the experience of going into meditation, being able to put all that selfing to rest, gives us, it kind of lubricates or loosens up the apparatus of selfing, which for many people has gotten frozen or stuck. And so that fluidity of going back and forth, I'm glad she talks about having the ability to go back and forth, because I think that's what, I think in mature Buddhist spirituality, that's what we want to come to, is that ability. Not to be stuck in one way or the other. Okay. So, breathe. Thank you.